Welcome back. Good to have you all with us here. We're about to take a look at some things happening to America and around the country, some very important issues that we're facing. We're here with Dr. Tara Bynum, joins us once again, Assistant Professor, Department of English at Towson University. Good to have you back, Tara.
It's good to be here.
Good to have you with us. Marta Mossberg is back with us, visiting fellow at the Maryland Public Policy Institute, a nationally syndicated columnist who joins us often here on the show. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
We are joined by the Reverend Meredith Moyes. No, she's not there yet. Oh, wrong hour. Sorry. We're joined by Amara Jones, who is economic justice contributor for ColorLines.com, served in the Clinton White House where he worked in international trade policy and writes for many other journals. And Amara, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Morning. How are you?
Good. Almost changed you into another human being looking at the wrong page. Good to have you with us. You all can
First
join.
First time I've ever been accused of being a reverend.
We can give you any title you want, man. Just tell us. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump onto our Facebook pages. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We have a lot of things we could talk about, and I'll let you all bring up the issues that you think are also relevant to this day that we should be talking about. I've been thinking a lot about the Jordan Davis case. We were had a lot of shows last week, but we were out because my family was in town, and I took some time with them. But all that kind of broke then, and people are still talking about it. We can look at that. The minimum wage battle is huge in America now in Congress. I think we could jump at it. And also this anti-gay legislation that was passed, what's being called anti-gay legislation being passed in Arizona, saying that if you own a restaurant or a club or a business, you do not have to allow people who are gay into that restaurant. So all these things, I think the three, we can start there. And folks, tell us where you'd like to start at 410-319-8888. But Amara, let me let you begin since you're joining us by Skype and going to the Jordan Davis case and the repercussions of that and of having he's been obviously he was only convicted for attempted murder charges, though he could spend the rest of his life in jail on that. But it's something deeper than just the notion of his spending the rest of his life in prison.
Yes, I mean, I think it's important to note that he could spend up to, and every legal analyst I've said is likely to spend up to 70 or 75 years in jail based upon his attempted murder convictions, which are very serious charges. The fact is that he's 47 and probably will not leave jail anytime before he leaves the planet. But I think that on some level, I'm surprised that people are still surprised that we get these verdicts, because one of the things that we haven't done and that we don't do very well in America is to continue to acknowledge and bring forth our past and to see the ways in which it's relevant. And the fact is that these different levels of applications of force on black men and what's justified and what the triggers are something that stretch way back right to the roots of slavery in terms of the way that masters and overseers dealt out punishment, the way that they rationalized doing that, saying that black men needed to be controlled in a certain way and that they didn't feel pain and were so brutish and savage and didn't feel pain in a certain way. And so certain levels of torture and sometimes even deadly force were justified. And the fact is that those stereotypes lived on, and we've confronted a lot of the legacy, the legal legacy of slavery. But until we sort of continue to confront its power and its psychological dimensions, those things that we don't want to do, these things keep happening on and on and on. And maybe what's so surprising is that we believe that because we have President Obama and there have been other levels of black achievement that these things shouldn't happen, that somehow there's been a fundamental change in America. But America is always a place where lots of different things can coexist simultaneously, and we sometimes find a way to rationalize it. And so I think it just points to the fact that we have a lot of work to do and that we haven't come as far as we would like to acknowledge. And until that happens, we're still going to have teenage boys who are murdered by white men and somehow, you know, are able to get away with it.
Well, I think it's dangerous to extrapolate this one case into this, you know, put it in this context of this huge history of the United States, because things have changed so much over 250 years. And you know, this case was awful. I mean, this guy was shooting at these kids as they were driving off. This obviously was not self-defense when you're looking at the evidence. But there's so many other cases. I mean, you look what's going on in the United States right now, these knockout games. There was a kid who was killed in 2012. A white boy was – a white young man, 20 years old, killed by an 18-year-old black boy – or black man, I should say. And he got 10 years. He was just sentenced this past month. And there's lots of these knockout things going on, and yet none of them are brought to the same level of attention as this case in Florida or the Zimmerman case, because it's black on white versus white on black. So how does this simultaneously exist in the United States as well? I mean, how is there no black racism? I mean, Greg Kane, who just passed away last week, very perceptive, insightful columnist for the Baltimore Sun and then Washington Examiner, grew up in poverty in Baltimore, wrote about black racism as well. I mean, I think that's something that needs to be brought up in this conversation if you're going to bring up this huge context of white racism, why this just this still happens.
Tara, and then before we go back to Tara, go ahead.
I think we also need to bring the question of power into the conversation. I mean, I think history is absolutely important. And as Amara was talking, I wasn't only reminded of just history, but history and the power of and power in that history, I think, is important. And I think that as we begin to think about the many other kind of violences that have happened in the United States, I think what makes Jordan Davis's case or Trayvon Martin's case so kind of important on a national scale is because it invites a conversation about power that we have not had, and the way that power is connected to ideas of privilege and power is connected to assumptions that we make about each other. And I think until we begin to actually talk about power and who has power, we're not going to get at why Jordan Davis and Trayvon Martin and the countless other of black children end up mattering.
Let me throw this out here. I mean, is it what was just brought up here? And we're going to go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Russ and Ernest, you're our first two callers up. We're going to get to your calls in just a couple of minutes. But the conversation just took place. And Amara, what you raised in response to what Amara was saying, Marta, is there a couple of things that struck me is one is this whole knockout thing that people have been talking about. It's really kind of a sparse activity. This is not something that is happening every day. It's not something that is going on in communities all the time. It's something, a story that Fox and other and some networks have exploded into this giant thing as if it's a way of life for young black kids in the street to walk up somebody and knock them out, which is not the truth. And it's been played like that. There's a fundamental difference between that, I think, and the whole idea of stand your ground, where 26 people who are under the age of 20 years old have been killed on Stand Your Ground. Most of the people who have done the killing have gotten let go. Many of the people being killed were black. Many of the perpetrators were white, but not all of them were white. And that Stand Your Ground was clearly a law that people say was passed in the South and in states states where really kind of right-wing conservative parties are in power and race is a major factor. So I think equating the two is kind of dangerous here.
Well, I mean, I don't in the sense of, you know, there, this that when you talk about this case, it makes it seem like this only happens in, you know, this white man killing these black teenagers, and that this is the only problem that we face in the United States. There's other issues. There's other people who are dying. It's just that they're not getting attention because they don't fit that narrative.
Well, can I to say something? I mean, I think that what was brought up right earlier is that the issue of power is really different. I think, first of all, there was a coordinated campaign by the NRA to implement these laws. And one of the ways in which they did that was by playing on racial fears. That's well documented. That's been laid out. And there's a reason why these laws gravitate towards certain states and not to others. And that's just something we could talk about a little later because you have callers waiting. The second thing, though, that I want to point to is that when we have these moments that are deeply resonant, they're deeply resonant because they signify something broader in our culture. The knockout games were sporadic. It's not even been proved that they are such a thing as real, quite frankly. But there is a real concern by many, many Americans that there is a coordinated, let me not say coordinated, but that there is an organized campaign of violence, broad-based violence against Black men. And that translates into the way that Black boys are disproportionately disciplined in school, the way that then translates into them more likely being picked up by the criminal justice system. That then means that they're more likely to be in jail and more likely to be unemployed. Young Black men unemployment is facing 50%. And as I'm an economist, and in economics, when we have broad-based trends, it's because they're systemic. They're not one-offs. They're not because people are individually wrong or bad or wrong-footed. It's because there's something systemically that's generating these massive, massive results to the point where we now have more people in jail than any other country on the planet, including China, which has four times as many people, and a communist oppressive regime. And so one of the reasons why people are so engaged in this issue is because they see it as deeply resonant to a much broader organized effort against a group of Americans that is deeply rooted in our past, and deeply rooted on racial stereotypes, and deeply rooted in fear and power, and that's what we have to address.
Comments before we open the phones? What Amara was saying? And what both our guests are saying here?
I absolutely agree, and I think that what has happened in particular in the media is a kind of refusal to talk about the way that power works to make this possible. And there's an entire history of power and privilege that's connected to white men in particular. And I think that the broad-based trend that that you're talking about is certainly very well documented and is so much part and parcel of the American system that it has become so normalized that, as you suggested earlier, we shouldn't be surprised by these events.
Let me open the phone. Mark, go ahead, Amara.
No, well, I mean, I just wonder, Amara, when the United States will have changed enough for you to recognize that we're no longer the same racist society that we were, you know, 100 years ago. It just seems like no matter what happens, that we're still the same people we were, that nothing changes. And that is what is disappointing to me, because it's kind of like, this is a horrible incident. Is this representative of how most white people think? No. And that's the issue for me.
Well, I think the point is that I would never say and never claim that the United States is, quote, still the same racist society that it's always been. I mean, I don't believe that. My own life speaks to that. The fact that my life is very different from my father's life and very different from my grandfather's life and very, very different from his grandmother's life. I mean, that speaks to that. I think what still is, and what's interesting, is this irritation that I sense, or frustration that I feel, and I think that it's justified, is that there's a difference between the way that individuals feel, and there's a difference, and then there's a difference between the way that systems play, and that systems work and power plays out and organizations work. And so individually, do I believe that most white people in America believe that a 17-year-old kid should have been gunned down and his friends gunned down by some guy while they were listening to loud music? No, I don't believe that. But do I believe that we're willing to necessarily confront that there's a possibility that it's reflective of a larger institutional bent that has never been addressed? Yes. And so I think that those, once again, these two things can coexist. We can have people individually feel one way, but where we've not necessarily addressed these other sort of forces at work in American history that have been unresolved.
Well, I just don't know what the institutional bent is now. What institutional bent are you talking about?
When you have the NRA mount a campaign in southern states that plays upon racial fears in order to get laws that allow people to be gunned down and not have to retreat and not have to prove that they are actually under threat, that is the fact that you can still use that in America means that that's an unaddressed issue. The fact that you can still play on racial fears, use racial code words to be able to work people up and play on their fears in order to change the laws in a certain way that penalize a certain group of people or put them at greater risk, that is what is. And the fact that you can still do that means that that's an issue that's unresolved. So we need to deal with that. The fact that we believe that we no longer have any unfinished business, that's not the work of a democracy. I mean, what we believe is that somehow because we passed laws 50 years ago that it's all done with everything on women's rights, right down the road. That doesn't make any sense.
So I guess with the difference, and part of that is, you know, if you look at and we'll open the phones here, if you look at something like 90% of almost all drug arrests in the state of Maryland are African-American kids and African-Americans in the prisons for drug abuse and drug use, where the numbers of people who actually use drugs, the majority of people who use drugs in our state are not African-American but are white, but nobody ever gets arrested or put in jail. I mean, those are the kind of institutional things I think that Imara is trying to say that complicates these issues. Stand on the Ground is being pushed by ALEC and pushed by other organizations.
Drug laws, definitely. I mean, that is an institutional issue, or mandatory minimums, things like that, or sentencing guidelines. Those are institutional things that I would say definitely need to change in order to right some of those wrongs he's talking about.
Let's see what our listeners are thinking. 410-319-8880, and come right back to our other guest, Tara Bynum. Bring her back in the conversation here. And Russ, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark, to you.
Hi,
and your guests.
Welcome.
Mark, I think when we have conversations like this about racism, or that include racism, what we do is we take an objective, rational type of yardstick and try to apply it to a process that is, one, totally subjective and totally irrational. And if you look at it objectively, yeah, we have integrated schools, we have public accommodations, and those things by law. But when you look at it subjectively, the idea of one person accepting another in his humanity as the same as himself, there's a lot to be desired. We're still back where Tardy said a black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect. As far as the gun and Zimmerman situation is concerned, who among us believes that either one of those guys would have engaged with the people that they did if they didn't have a pistol? And lastly, let me just say that when you get out of your vehicle, you're the initiator of the whatever the incident turns out to be. How can you then turn around and say you were so afraid for your life that you had to pull out a pistol and shoot somebody when you had the safety, security of your vehicle or whatever else you had going for you in that instance? I don't see how you could provoke it. Come to me, get a reaction from me, and then kill me because I react and say you were standing your ground. Mark, I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much. Let's get one more call in here and come back to our guest. 410-319-8888. Ernest, you're on the air.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, things, being an African-American man, being in law enforcement for the majority of my life, things are the same. Anytime a young man is sitting in a car playing loud music, and another white man in his car, keys in ignition, don't pull off and say, well, I'm annoyed, but I'm just going to pull off, going to reach in his glove compartment and kill him. Yeah, things are the same, and he thought he could get away with it. And the reason why he thought he'd get away with it, because he knew in that area, white people are not going to find a white man guilty in an incident like this. They're not going to find it. It was jury nullification right from the start. It was 9-3. 9 people said that he committed murder. 3 people said he didn't. And I can guarantee you that the 3 people that said he didn't was white, and they was not going to make a change. Now, he came up with the...
We have to take a very quick break here. We can come right back at 410-319-8888. I'm going to ask Tara Bynum to jump right back in this conversation, get to the callers, Mary and Clarence, Bruce. We get your calls, 410-319-8888.
I said you let me slide. I have the rent for it, I'm more than next, I don't know. So let me slide it on. You know.
George Thorogood, 1 bourbon, 1 scotch, 1 beer. So we celebrate him today on this day. This is a day. I've forgotten what he did on this day. I think he passed away on this day. I'll get that right in a minute. I apologize. Yes, he did. And he was born on this day in 1950, George Thorogood, singer-songwriter, and one bourbon, one scotch, one beer. It's a little too early in the day. We're here with Marta Marsberg, who is visiting fellow with the Maryland Public Policy Institute and nationally syndicated columnist, and Mara Jones, economic justice contributor for ColorLines.com, who served in the Clinton White House on international trade policy, and Dr. Tara Bynum, assistant professor in the Department of English at Towson University, 410-319-8888. Before we get back to the calls, you've heard a lot, Tara. Why don't you give us some thought?
You know, I think the thing to remember when thinking about these cases that make national news is that what they have us observe is kind of a very complicated systemic problem. And I think that it's easy to imagine that what we are talking about is one white man and one young black teenage boy. But when we actually situate it within the systems, there are systems that comprise American society, I think it begins to certainly make sense, not only because of history, but because of those power dynamics that I mentioned earlier. You know, I think we have to think for a moment, like, how did Michael Dunn learn to fear black bodies in this way? We can go to the media and see the various ways in which the media has, I think, vilified and criminalized black male bodies in particular. And I think that in and of itself has a history that is both legal and also kind of popular culture. And I think that is kind of a critical component to this conversation is remembering that these issues are absolutely systemic. They're absolutely institutionalized. And I think instead of kind of focusing so much on these two people as individuals, understanding that they are part of a very American kind of sensibility, I think that's the way to begin to approach what it is that we are actually talking about, the underlying themes.
There have been 26 people under the age of 20 killed since Stand Your Ground was made law in just Florida alone. And where Stand Your Ground laws do exist, the vast majority of people who have been killed have been African-American or Native American or Mexican. And I think that's – and in Maryland we have a law that says – what's the law you were talking about?
Oh,
you have to retreat.
A duty to retreat.
A duty to retreat.
Outside of your home.
Outside of your home, yes.
Outside of your home, a duty to retreat. They're very different kind of social sensibilities and sense of what that means, to have those two various viewpoints of how we approach our lives and what we do around us. I mean, and people have been killed in Florida. There was a guy who was – I was looking these up. A young man, 19 years old, named Christopher Coate, had a dispute because he walked his dog on his neighbor's property, came to talk to Coate. He was unarmed. Coate came to talk to his neighbor, Jose Taponas. He was unarmed, the 62-year-old man. They got into an argument. He answered the door with a shotgun. He stepped outside on the lawn, shot Coate twice. They wouldn't give him the Stand Your Ground immunity during his first trial, but he was granted a new trial where he was acquitted on Stand Your Ground. There's like I could read a dozen more cases just like this that are over the top, it seems, in America, where, I mean, Stand Your Ground is kind of the heart of the body of the controversy.
Yes and no. I mean, with the Trayvon Martin case, I mean, that ultimately had nothing to do with Stand Your Ground. So, I mean, that was brought up after the case by Eric Holder and a lot of other people who wanted to get rid of those laws. But that case, that it didn't hinge on that at all. That was not part of the trial.
Maybe the not by law, but by sensibility.
Right.
And wasn't it a part of the jury instructions? I think it was a part of the jury instructions. Because Stand Your Ground actually changed the actual jury instructions that people get in murder trials in Florida. So even if it didn't come up, even if it wasn't raised as a specific defense, it is in the jury instructions. And I remember at the close of the trial, there was a debate between both sides about whether or not it could be referenced in closing because the judge was going to give jury instructions that had already been written by the law.
I mean, the bigger issue to me is, I mean, when you look at, you know, when we were talking about Wyoming earlier when off air, but in states that have concealed carry laws, or in Wyoming, you don't even need a permit now. It's just it's kind of a free for all, and there's no. I mean, they have such a low murder rate. So, Baltimore, Maryland has a very high murder rate comparatively speaking, and those are all illegal guns. So, standard. You know, at the end of the day, I don't really think that this is the biggest issue out there. It's more than guns. It's about people making bad decisions. It's about the city. It's about drug culture. It's about a number of things rather than just this stand your ground laws.
Of course,
but stand your ground is about who gets away with murder, not necessarily who gets murdered. So saying, you know, these places that don't have these other laws have, you know, higher murder rates, et cetera, I think the discussion and the content is about who gets away with murder once it happens, not necessarily which murders take place.
Okay, who's getting away with murder in the city? I mean, it's not white people. It's not black. I mean, it's everyone who gets away with murder in the city. It's,
well, that's not quite true either. Everyone gets
well,
away with murder
okay,
in the
but
city.
No one's going to prison. I mean, everyone gets off. Let's just put it that way. A lot of people get off.
For murder?
Yes.
No. I don't think that can be. I mean,
well, a lot of people get away with things. Let's
there may
just put
be unproven
way.
Cases where people have not been arrested mm-hmm. for murders, but people who put on trial for murder, by and large, go to jail for murder in Maryland.
Mm-hmm. Well, no one. No, I would say that very few people are willing to testify against people in the city. That's one issue. You have, I just don't think when you talk about stand your ground and how it's a racist law. I mean, what's racist is what's going on in the city. The fact that so many people are dying and not getting a good education and on and on and on. So,
Tara,
I think that what we are presenting here sounds like something that is hinging on an either or. And I don't think that that's it. I think that this is and. So it's not that stand your ground isn't a problem or isn't a part of America's racist past. It is. And it's the case that cities have problems as well. And I think that what we need to be able to do in this conversation and others is acknowledge both of those realities. And I think this goes to Imar's earlier point about America being a place of paradox and also a place of and. I'm reminded of those commercials that it's not sweet or sour chicken, it's sweet and sour chicken. You know, so I think that as we have this conversation, we need to kind of keep in mind that these thoughts don't have to exist in an either or environment, but instead are a part of an and. How do we deal with city problems and urban problems while also acknowledging that the legal system, which seems to be what we are debating, in fact, is broken and is also extremely biased in its effort to be non-biased.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Get a couple of quick calls. We have a lot of people calling in. We're going to Bruce and Mary in that order. Then I'm going to ask you a question about a different issue. But folks, you can bring up any issue you'd like in the course of this conversation at 410-319-8888. So Clarence and James, you want to continue your thoughts about what we've been talking about now, please do. 410-319-8888. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, you know, I got to keep my cool, but I get so fired.
Yes, you do.
So, you know what? You can express any opinion. Your one guest, a guy that's an economist, he's particularly biased. So, you know what? Whenever an incident, so the incident happened in Florida, it happened. Was this guy guilty? I don't know. Most of he was, but I don't know. But we all speculate, and right away, he's representative of the racist white people. He's representative of the racist. He's not. That's an individual. But you play this stupid little game, you make these ridiculous exaggerations, these ridiculous statements that are so inflammatory, it's unbelievable, and you rationalize it. It's like the whole system is biased against blacks. The whole system is biased. You're living in the past. You know what? I don't like that slavery existed. I don't like that Jim Crow existed either. But what it is you use the past to rationalize contemporary things. It's ridiculous.
All right. Bruce, thank you so much. Let's go. You want to respond since she called your name out?
No.
We just even know.
Oh, well, I guess it's talk radio. I have to say something.
You got to say something.
I mean, sometimes, you know, oftentimes, times people will react to what they think you're saying and not actually what you said. And I think that this is one of the cases. I did not say that he's representative of all white people in America. I do not believe that in any shape, form, or fashion. I do believe that America has a lot of institutional and systemic issues that need to be dealt with that are rooted in race and rooted in our past. Some of those have been dealt with in very effective ways, others haven't. And I think that we come up against a barrier when we believe that, well, because some things have changed, this can't be anything other than a one-off and we have to keep it moving. And the problem is that when you look at the systemic result of the way that we are ignoring these very real problems that we continue to have, they have dire consequences. It's why, you know, it translates into every single metric for people of color and why they don't do as well. And because we have these other examples that when you change the circumstances and allow people to be on an actual equal footing, that these things largely go away. So I think that he was reacting to what he thought I was saying, not to actually what I said, which is why my initial answer was, no, I don't respond to that because I can't answer for something I didn't say.
410-319-8888. Mary, you're on the air. Hi, Mary.
This
welcome.
This is an incident of systemic racism that has not been dealt with and is still supported in America. And it is racist. And we need to deal with the racism and the historical facts of racism. To me, the Stand Your Ground law is no different from the Ku Klux Klan putting ropes around people's necks. Now it has simply been legalized in the justice system. And if we would look at all the history, we could see it. But we want to look at something called a non-racial society, which is an oxymoron, and want to say, oh, this is not from racism. This is just this one incident. This is systemic racism being allowed to raise its ugly head again. It's tantamount to the Ku Klux Klan. And we need to get a handle on it now. And that law needs to be abolished anywhere it exists. It needs to be abolished. Should be taken to the Supreme Court to make sure it's abolished all over this country.
All right, Mary, appreciate the call. And I think that, I think the heart of some of the heart of the matter in this question has to do with the laws that are being passed, whether it's this law, the laws that's taking place in throughout the South and the West. I mean, when you talked about Wyoming, we had Jossie Rawson here some months back talking just about after the Trayvon Martin's case, was talking about how all through Indian country, whether it's Wyoming, Montana, South Dakota, that there are hundreds of cases of Native Americans who have been killed and shot. People never gone to jail for the killing. A lot of the killers were white, and cases have never been solved. I mean, there are all kinds of levels to this conversation that don't see the light of day.
Well, it's a very, I mean, both callers, very incredibly emotional on both sides. You know, you've got to look at, you have to look at the, I think you have to go back to the facts of this case. What this guy did was wrong. He was convicted. He's going to be in prison for a very long period of time, as he should. And this type of thing should never happen. And the more that you see that someone's convicted for doing something like this, hopefully it has a deterrent effect on the people who want to go out and do it next time.
Can I just say one quick thing?
Go ahead, Amara.
I think that the emotion actually shows us a point that I was trying to underscore before, and that is to say that a lot of these issues are still unresolved. I mean, if someone were to make a joke about if someone were to say something about stoning witches, we'd all bust out into laughter, and that's because the last time a witch was stoned was 500 years ago. But the fact is that people can make these arguments about the past and get very emotional on both sides means that we have a lot of unresolved issues. And this is what I'm saying, that regardless of the facts in this case, and I think the facts in this case are abhorrent and speak for themselves, but the fact that we can immediately go to a place where we talk about the legacy of this, of a lot of these systemic issues that continue to exist, shows us that we have a lot of progress to make. And I think that that's a point that people are very insistent upon, that we have a lot of unfinished business in this country.
Let's go to the phone. Let's switch gears for a moment, then we'll go back to the phones. One of the battles taking place in Maryland, but taking place across the country, is over the issue of minimum wage. and whether the raise is at $10.10 an hour. And it's in the United States Congress. It's in state legislatures across the country. There was a piece that I saw on Real News Network where they did on interviewing a woman who has a $10.10 job, an hour job, and she talked about what it takes to live on that. I mean, $10.10, I'm looking at all four people on this panel right now, and most people in this station, who the thing about, could you live on $10.10 an hour? So we're raising the wage to $10.10 an hour. But what does that mean? Amara, talk about that from your perspective as a former, from an insider in the White House, and let's go around the table.
Really quickly, I think that this is just an economic no-brainer for a lot of different reasons. I think the fact is the fact that we have, most of the people in this country who are poor work and are their children. That's who are poor in this country, people that work. They're poor because they don't earn enough in order to be able to make a living. And that is a structural problem. That's a law that we have that allows people to work and be poor in this country. That we need to change that. And if we do that, millions of people are going to be lifted out of poverty. 28 million people are going to get a pay raise. It's going to do a lot. One of the other things it's going to do is it's going to stimulate demand and do a lot of different things in terms of adding income and boosting incomes and wages in this country that are at a 40-year low. And once again, they're at a 40-year low, not because the economy hasn't produced, because it has, but because we've changed the rules in such a way where all of those gains have gone to the top 1%, and they haven't been redistributed in terms of fair wages to people who've actually created that wealth. And so we need to change that rule. Of course, there was a big problem last week or issue last week where the CBO said that, that it's going to lift people out of poverty but cost jobs. It doesn't really make sense to me as an economist. And 60 other different studies say the exact opposite. 7 Nobel Prize winners disagree with it. And when you actually read the methodology in the report, it's really kind of unprecedented what they've done. They said that basically all of the United States 40-year experience with a minimum wage doesn't apply to this minimum wage because it's going to be so different. And so they created new rules around how to figure out what it's going to do and came up with these kind of outlier results. And so I think we're still in the same place. Economically, this is a no-brainer. We need to do it. We can't have a country where most people who work are poor, or the poor that are those that are work and have children. And we can change it. And it's a pretty straightforward way to do it.
Marta and then Tara.
First of all, if you really want to change the outlook for most poor people, you need a job, And 3%, I think it's less than 3% of people in the United States who are working are earning minimum wage. Most of those people within the first year get an increase or get a bump. The other big issue is that most of the people earning a minimum wage are not heads of household. They live in households, actually, that make more than $2,000 over the median income in the United States. I mean, this is all census data. So if you really want to help people, raising the minimum wage is not the way to do it. And, as a Congressional Budget Office estimated, you could lose employment as a result. And, I mean, some of the people you're going to hurt the most are teenagers, and also specifically African-American and other minority teenagers who have super high unemployment. As you said earlier, Amara, I thought you said it was about 50% for African-Americans or teens. So how is making it more difficult for them to get a job a good thing for them?
Because that's not going to happen. That statistic that you just quoted in terms of how it's going to destroy jobs is actually one, as I said, an outlier. It doesn't make any sense both methodologically and economically. It just doesn't make sense if you actually go through it. The second thing is that the fastest growth of the people that have minimum wage jobs are actually older workers. And one of the reasons why there's such employment is because older workers' job prospects have so decreased in this market that they've had to take these minimum wage jobs and displace younger people. And so a disproportionate number of the increase of people that are on minimum wage are heads of households. And that's why we have this skewed number of where half of the people that are poor are those people that work and have children.
Well, you know, could I add one thing quickly? If you look at Europe, there's seven countries that don't have a minimum wage, and those Austria, Cyprus, Denmark, Finland, Germany, Italy, and Sweden, and they have a much lower unemployment rate than those that do have a minimum wage. It's actually 7.9% versus 11.8%. That's a significant difference.
But if you want, but Marty, well, fairness, if you want to take their example, you've got to take also the fact that there are countries that have a higher tax rate for the rich and a higher tax rate of industry. There's the countries that have a huge social underpinning that makes sure that people don't slip into poverty. Those are
exactly.
countries that have single payer health systems, so everyone has health care.
Right, but why the discrepancy then between
job training? They have an entire safety net that we don't have that mitigates the fact that they don't have a minimum wage.
No, but all these we're looking at apples to apples over there with all these countries having those same things minus the minimum wage issue. Why is unemployment so much higher in those countries that do have a minimum wage versus those that don't?
You're not looking at apples to apples.
Because
you are.
Because we don't have the protections for workers and poor people in this country as other people do. In the countries you mentioned.
Right. They don't need to have a minimum wage because they have guaranteed childcare. They have longer unemployment. They have more intense job training. They have health care. They have free education for people who are doing post-secondary.
I'm not comparing the United States against Europe. I'm comparing Europe against Europe. And the countries within Europe that do not have a minimum wage have much better employment statistics than those that do. So that's what I'm talking about.
Let me go to Tara, but you don't include Germany in that picture. I mean, their economy they have a fairly low employment rate. They have a minimum wage. I think it's very difficult to kind of...
The UK has a minimum wage, and they have the fastest job growth in Europe right now, and they have a minimum wage.
So Tara, back to Marta.
Well, I guess I admit I don't know a whole lot about the minimum wage debate, but I do wonder why anyone would... why argue against increasing the minimum wage? I know I understand the idea of costing jobs, but if that's not a real factor, then what?
It is a factor. I mean, Amara doesn't believe it's a factor, but the Congressional Budget Office says it's a factor.
And neither do seven Nobel Prize winning economists or 60 other studies that have been done over the past 25 years on the minimum wage.
Well, then why does having a living wage? Baltimore was one of the first places in the country, I think the first place in the country, to enact a living wage. Why is Baltimore not lifted out of poverty as a result of that?
Because
why are all these other cities who have enacted living wages not lifted out of poverty?
Well, I can't speak to Baltimore specifically, but I think what I could say is that a minimum wage has to be in the context of a whole host of other things that deal with, that spiral out in terms of education and job training and safety and environmental and strong environmental protection, so that we have children that grow up strong and safe and ready to learn. That there's an entire ecosystem, and so you can't isolate one thing in one place and say, well, you know, that would just be like saying, well, if we had this one thing, then everything else would be different. I think that's why we have to look at the national picture on the minimum wage. And the national picture on the minimum wage is that a minimum wage at a certain level is really key to lifting people out of poverty. As a matter of fact, it's played a huge role, not a huge role actually, in income inequality, especially amongst women. There's the two-thirds of the gap between middle income women and lower income women is as a result of the fact that we haven't raised the minimum wage in a really long time. And so there's lots of different evidence that the minimum wage is key. I mean, and the only way to argue against it is to take things that are either outliers that no one else is saying, or to isolate these very, you know, specific variables and say, well, why isn't it that way? And that's just not the way we do it.
I mean, the Congressional Budget Office is not nobody. So
this report is an outlier. They generate tons of reports. This report is an outlier. It's not reflected anywhere else. And the way that they decided to do it and the choices they made terms of modeling are just not done, are not really done.
So I want to thank all of you for being here. Let me just say that one of the questions we can explore next time is that what does it say about a society, our society, any society, where people are working and cannot make a living wage? And that's the bottom line issue for all of this. There are too many people in this country not making a living wage and struggling to make it, but they can't afford housing and other things. What is the solution to that? Maybe we can have a good roundtable about that with Amara Jones, economic justice contributor for Color Lines, Dr. Tara Bynum, professor in the Department of English at Towson University, Marta Mossberg, visiting fellow at the Melville Policy Institute,
Thank
and
you.
Columnist. Good to have all
Thank
three
you.
Of you with us.
Thank you.
And let me just announce, it came over the wire today that just now as we were on the air, that the longest-serving congressman, John Dingell, Democrat from Detroit, He's retiring after 60 years. He said, I'm not going to be carried out feet first. I don't want people to think I stayed too long. So,
Unlike most people in Congress.
So good to have you all with us. We're going to take a brief break and come right back to our local roundtable. Stay with us.